All right, is everyone ready? I'm going to start this
thing. I don't know. A lot of pressure.
I got my thunderbolts ready.
This show is not for the easily offended, so if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
All right, Indie Comic Book Noise listeners, you've demanded it. We're all back. It's time for the first ever decade retrospective by the Indie Comic Book Noise podcast.
It's a reunion show.
And as a special treat, we have all four regular hosts in attendance. Those regular hosts are, you heard Super Steve launch in from the bunker.
I am here.
We have the Ottawa Otter, Phil, dialing in from up north.
You can't mean me. I'm not the Ottawa Otter.
We have WWX in his Fortress of Solitude.
It's the return of Zeke Deadwood.
Ooh, Zeke Deadwood.
And me, Andrew.
It's a blast from,
The past. Sorry, Andrew. Forget about you. Zeke Deadwood. Don't get me started. No, Andrew, you've pulled us all together. You've pulled on those threads that you shouldn't tug on and managed to still get something that resembles a form kind of on the table here. So, yay.
Well, I was originally poo-pooing the idea of a decade retrospective, but it was yourself and Kevin's eloquent defense of the idea that turned me around 100%. Indie Comic Book Noise is part of the Deliberate Noise Network. You can find our old shows at indiecomicbooknoise.com, which I will be referencing later. Ooh, there's a little bit of foreshadowing. This episode may not be particularly indie because we've done some research and taken notes, damn it. As you heard from the disclaimer at the beginning, this is a mature audience show, but generally speaking, all that means is a little bit of rough language from time to time. We're pretty friendly fellows all around. You can find the podcast on Facebook. You can also find it on Twitter, Indie Comic Book N. We all have our individual handles, which I will skip telling for now.
But it's tradition to allude to the fact that we do.
Yes. If anyone's particularly anxious to really let one of us have it, I want them to know that option is there. Well, I really want them to encourage to interact with the podcast on Twitter. It's fun. It does its own thing.
You just don't want to have to take the heat for something Kevin said.
I also don't want to have to spell out all our dumb handles. So mine is particularly unwieldy. Kevin's has too many W's. Phil's never on Twitter.
Ottawa Otter at.
And mine and yours should have been Super Steve in the bunker instead of whatever the heck you ended up with. So
I don't believe that we have individual handles. I think it's all a ruse.
So for long-standing Indie Comic Book Noise fans, if you turn back the clock to January 2010 and dialed up the podcast on the 10th, you would have heard Indie Comic Book Noise number 302. And you would have heard Derek Coward as the host.
What?
Derek Coward is the big boss of all the Noise Network. And we owe him an immense debt of gratitude. He's the one that lines up all the ones and zeros, makes sure everything works when we get attacked and hacked, and when Kevin leaves backdoor passwords laying around all the Russian forums he goes to.
Yep.
Hey, Kevin's a guy from Dawn of the Dead.
One time I couldn't reach the cookie jar, Derek was there.
So I wanted to give a thanks, and if you have an interest, you can go, as I always say, look up old episodes, and that would be Derek. He ran his shows around a half hour, and it would just be him spotlighting new and older books. That one was during the boom Mark Waid era of Irredeemable and all them other ones. You know, all the Superman Gone Bad.
That was a thing for a while, wasn't it?
Yes.
I'm actually halfway through rereading Irredeemable right now.
And then our first episode was Indie Comic Book Noise number 329. That was on October 24th, 2013.
I was going to say, it was a Halloween episode.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sure we kept a steady schedule, too.
Nope.
No. We are the fourth iteration of this show. If you are curious, you can go to the episode before us, which is 328, about 15 minutes in. Derek gives a history of Indie Comic Book Noise, and he also touches on Marvel Noise and Bullpen Bulletin. Derek's been podcasting for a very long time.
I figured it was always Derek before us.
No, he goes through all the different hosts. At one time, it was a team, and he was on the third iteration for mm-hmm. us to take over the fourth. It's a little bit sad because he's like, yeah, and now I'm never going to appear on this podcast again. But he gives his reasons. Like I said, if you're curious, it's 15 minutes in, and it's about 15 minutes. And if you're like, what was podcasting like in the last decade, Derek? I mean, he continues to podcast to this day. The flagship show, Comic Book Noise, is still him. So it's not like he's gone on to the Great Reward or anything.
Well, the reason that we are doing this show is because we were the Marvel Noise guys, and we wanted to do like a bonus fourth hour kind of a thing that where we could talk about some indie books too and still have our regular Marvel content and everything, but Derek preferred to keep the Marvel Noise pure as possible.
He didn't want it to end up like DC Noise.
Exactly. Here's this other little place you could go, and I have it, you know, the lights were on, the heat was going, all the ones and the zeros, like you said, they're all lined up.
Yeah, so I just always make sure I want to take time to thank him for continuing to run it to this day. I don't know about web hosting and all that nonsense, so it's on his good graces. And then the only other thing I wanted as a preface is, Kevin and I joke about this all the time, but we're really going to basically blow off the big story of the decade, which is clearly that, like, kids' comics are it. This is the decade of Telga Meyer and all those who have sales that stomp the direct market flat, sideways, in each way. None of us really get into those books that much. I mean, I don't have any beef with them, but Diary of a Wimpy Kid and all that stuff, they're huge. It's the future. It's for real. They sell millions and millions and millions of them. And here in Indie Comic Book Noise, we just sort of acknowledge it, but don't. I mean, if you guys have any thoughts on those things.
Well, I buy my kid Diary of the Wimpy Kid. She reads it, but it's not a comic book.
Yeah, no. My kids read it all, too.
Yeah, yeah. So these things exist. But I feel like they're comics. They may not be comic books, but they're...
No, there's graphical? Just every once in a while, there'll be like a little cartoon the guy draws, but it's mostly just a book.
They're spot illustrations.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the Telga Meyer, the Smile book and Guts and all that stuff, I believe those are straight up regular comics.
Well, listen, just like I was saying, though, this show was never meant to be, we're going to be the caretakers of the indie comic book world and be, you know, your conduit to it. This is our opportunity to blow off some steam about the indie books we're reading because, you know, we got tired of talking about the Hulk.
True, but I feel like it's our duty to recognize that, yes, we know this huge phenomenon is happening and it doesn't really interest us. Except we do know, save your comments about all these giant books. And I'm glad. And I think part of it might be, at least in my youth, because I'm 100 years old, we still had Peanuts and Far Side. And I wonder if now that there's none of that stuff around, kids always like comics.
And it gets my kid into comics, which is good. There are weird comics, yeah, I'd never read, but it's a good doorway for to read my comics later on.
There was one that was a make your own, like Diary of a Wimpy Kid book. Mm-hmm. So it encouraged you to write a little blurb and then draw a little spot illustration and that kind of a thing. And, mm-hmm. You know, that's that, like you said, it's a good catalyst.
And it's a little bit older, but I did like the Bone books, which also had enormous popularity, more probably outside the direct market than inside. But
yeah, I buy Bone for like my nephews and stuff.
Yeah,
so that's a great one for them.
It's that Scholastic, man. Once you're connected to that.
The ordinary scope of the show is we suggest a property or media tie-in or something that's indie, and we all discuss it. This being a retrospective, it'll be a little bit different in that regard, but Kevin was kind enough to type up some of his thoughts.
Well, you told me you had these half-assed... What did you say? Not notes. You used a different word.
Research. I have.
Oh, yeah. Half-assed research. And then I emailed you guys and said, well, I have some half-assed notes.
Yeah, well, they were half-assed because you forgot Deadly Class.
No, it's on there. It's on there.
Okay, then I half-assed read it, I guess.
Yeah, because if you look, I have Deadly Class / Low in amongst the scribbles.
I'm talking about the TV show, though.
That's the episode you weren't on.
Oh.
I didn't want to recover a lot of that stuff again, where we go, did we watch this show? No, we didn't. Now we're going to talk about it.
Well, my notes are just a couple of handwritten pages, so they look like something out of a serial killer's diary. So I thought I would not directly waste your time with them, but just sprinkle them through. We can look at... I have a few rough outside trends we can discuss. We can go by publisher. And I also have a little treat. John Jackson Miller at Comicron compiles the diamond numbers, which indicate the top-selling books. And so I found the top two indie books for each of the 10 years of the decade, obviously with the proviso I gave in the 2019 wrap-up that the 2019 numbers are not final because we're recording this in December. So if some huge big indie seller dropped in the last couple of weeks, those numbers will be off. And they put a ton of provisos that it's just the diamond numbers. But still, I thought it would be funny to talk about those. But I wanted to say, if you guys had anything you wanted to say or how you want to go, I'm opening the floor before I turn this into too much of a dictatorship.
We're in the future.
You make it sound so fun.
We will be going through my notes meticulously.
Whoa. What about my notes?
If we have time.
I think we need to spend like 1 minute each on my notes, and then we'll be here for a few hours.
Well, which half of the ass are we going to camp out on?
We save some time because I have zero notes.
Nice.
Well, I think a publisher talking about makes sense, and I see Kevin and I both mentioned Valiant came back in 2012.
Oh, yeah.
Even I got the bug.
And what I thought was interesting and unrelated to the quality of the books was all these things dropped in like the 30 and 40,000 sellers and sort of dwindled down now to the couple thousand a piece. Plus they abandoned they originally were doing old school numbering, but have jumped onto the Dark Horse Marvel reboot style.
Yeah. Well, for me, what made me drop off is when they started doing all those crossovers like crazy. And I think that's where they lost a lot of people because they were just putting out too many books, I think.
I don't know.
Great creators, though. Mm-hmm. Even, I mean, I don't... Those books started when I was out of comics, and so I never really had a connection to them when they came back the first time and were rebranded in, like, the early 90s and all that. So it was always just a blind spot that I let stay blind. But it doesn't mean I don't flip through there in the previous catalog and just see what creators are involved and stuff. And it's always a fantastic bunch of guys and the covers and stuff. So I give them a lot of credit in their editorial talent acquiring department.
That's why I'm excited for 2020. Because all those early Image guys, well, I shouldn't say all. I'm sure there's like a couple guys missing or something like that. Or depends how far you want to cast your net. But anyways, a bunch of those guys from the Valiant relaunch are all together again doing some crazy comics project for 2020. So very interested in that.
For Valiant?
Not for Valiant.
No. Oh.
Because the guy that was doing all the Valiant stuff, he has his own thing now with like media and TV and everything.
This is so cryptic.
Apparently there's some comics coming out too.
Oh, that's how it always goes with Valiant. Now it's Broadway, now it's this, now it's that.
Yeah, where's our movies, Kevin?
Bloodshot's coming out in March.
Like how we blame Kevin.
I know, it's because he was pretty pushy that they were coming out.
Hey, it got pushed out of the month that where you used to just drop stuff if you thought, oh, this isn't going to do well. So I don't know what that means.
I think I fell into the Super Steve camp of not being a previous Valiant fan, but I picked up books here and there and enjoy it. Like you say, always top creators. It just didn't hook me in a way. I mean, you know, the glass cover variant comic and that sort of thing do seem interesting, but it's not enough for me to buy it.
I feel you need to have a bit of love for the older stuff too, maybe.
So you're saying I was the outlier again? Well, and this is the year of me saying I'm the outlier.
All right, Kevin, give us the sale. Tell us the December 2019 plot lines to get us excited for Valiant 2020.
Plot lines for the future.
Yeah, like give us a taste. Why should we jump on in 2020?
And it better not be Exo Manowars in space again.
I actually don't know what's happening at the Exo Manowar, because I think it was supposed to launch in November from Dennis Hopeless, and they pushed it back to, what was it, March or something like that?
Well, you're the Valiant guy, Kevin.
So. And then, I already talked about The Visitor by Paul Levitz, where instead of, he wanted to do like the... mixing up the cities, like the original was in LA and then he wanted to do one that's specific to New York, or was it New York and LA? I don't know, something like that, where the city was like a big part of the thing. I feel like I've said this. I don't know. Anyhow, the original Visitor was actually one of the Valiant characters from like the future coming to the present, and was a big reveal, but that was like right towards the end of they claim Valiant first time run type of thing. So they're going to do a little bit of a modern mystery story thing with the new Visitor.
And are the titles still closely intertwined, or can you read them separately?
I don't think they were ever super intertwined.
Phil just said he stopped reading when all the crossovers happened.
I mean, a crossover is a crossover, but that, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Like, and that was the original guys doing the crossover too. So, I don't know what to say about that. Like, they're not doing massive crossovers anymore. If they have an event, usually it's in a self-contained mini. At least that's how the last few have gone.
Valiant is dead.
That's what people keep telling me for the last few years, and they still keep going.
Well, I got to think the value of the media property alone, but certainly on sales, they can't be happy that they're not where they were in 2012 and 2013.
I think you sold them a little short where they were in 2013, 2014 or whatever. Because there was, I think it was it Unity? That was maybe their third year or something. It was 60,000.
Yeah, they had some good hits, but look at November 2019. Kevin.
But this is the danger of looking at the direct market too, because people will argue, oh, it's still immensely important, even if it's down to 2% of the entire comic book sales, it's still very accurate for the direct market. I'm like, yeah, but there's other avenues. Like, what? Just like the whole thing with the smile and we ignore all those books. I'm like, yeah, like they sell a certain amount of direct market, but, you know. I don't know. It's not an accurate picture between digital and outside the direct market.
It is. It's not. But I would say that I don't think Valiant you're going to find on any of the top 300 books like Smile. I mean, you're telling me that Valiant and Smile are contemporary hits?
Oh, they're totally the same, Andrew. That's why they won't. That's why no one releases their sales numbers, because they don't want to say they're the same as Smile.
So I think Valiant, but for the movie properties, I don't know, because anecdotally, and this isn't evidence, but there used to be tons of Rat copies at the stores I go to, and I see a lot less. Now it's one market, so maybe people that buy it, but it doesn't seem like they want to leave a bunch of shelf copies like you used to be able to pick up.
I mean, you can make the same argument for Death of the Superhero and why it's going away. So, I don't know.
I don't know personally, Kevin.
I don't know. I don't think Marvel's average book is under 4K on the Diamond Direct market.
I don't know. The interesting thing is, if the movie fails, they don't do so, you know, the publisher's not doing so well. Someone can buy the company again and, like, do what happened when they relaunched in 2012. Like, I don't know. I don't know what people are really hoping for right there. Like, some other fan's going to buy the company?
Well, it's weird. The movies are kind of locked in, though, because of the joint financing. I think they'll do well enough. I don't think they can fail, in a sense, because they were built for the international market.
That's the weird thing. You have the whole international market, too. Like, your movie could be, like, big in Russia or big in China or something, and then you don't really need, like, other countries.
Yeah, so I think that it's guaranteed to, because they have they're making it with the Chinese companies, aren't they? So they'll have a strong market there. And there's over a billion of them.
I don't know. Is Vin Diesel big in China?
Well, I also think that they have less movie options in the theaters. I believe they have some minimum locally produced content. That's why some of those Marvel movies had the extra Chinese cuts and everything, so they could get them to air over there.
But maybe there'll be something weird in the movie. Will they be like, that guy ate an apple, banned?
I think they're working very closely. I don't think you hire a Chinese, you know, have Chinese production companies and they're going to fail to notice whatever weird nonsense they monitor over there. I mean, the same thing with here. Like, I think nudity might nuke your superhero movie. I don't know. Maybe you can get away with, like, a racy superhero movie. Wasn't that the point of Deadpool? The Joker?
Well, yeah, that's what I thought the point of Deadpool was, was to break all the stuff. Isn't that why people went to go see that movie? Because he did all the things you can't do. He killed a kid, ate a dog.
I saw both of them, and I think they still avoided the sex stuff. I mean, they implied it, but they didn't show as much of it as I think America still gets nervous around
that. One of the Swamp Things has boobs.
The Witcher does, apparently.
Yeah, but that's also got them Europeans. They're fine with nudity.
What are you saying about Europeans, Andrew?
I'm saying they're not hung up about nudity like America. But that's Valiant.
That took way too long for nothing.
All right, well, let's move on.
Valiant is awesome.
I just tuned out, and then you said boobs, and I was like, I sat back up straight.
Wow.
Let's go. How about Image? Image had, obviously, Robert Kirkman. The Walking Dead hit some pretty big highs. It ended thanks to Phil. The hit TV show. They had Saga that came out.
Monstrous.
Their whole decade was, I thought, fantastic. Like, I have some of my favorite Image books definitely came out in this decade. Like the Minotaur one I liked.
They have a ton of books, but I feel like they have less books right now that I'm interested. Not necessarily that's a bad thing. It's just because they have books for different audiences.
Mm-hmm. Is it that they have less ongoing series and more? Like, that's how I think of this decade for them, is that they kind of settled into this niche where they stopped trying to be any kind of an alternate superhero type universe, and, you know, less capes and less ongoing, really long reaching type series, you know, The Walking Dead excluded, because they acquired that along with Kirkman.
I don't know.
And just more, I mean, you know, there's still Savage Dragon there, and it's gone through its own evolution. But
most of them would go to, like, it would either be miniseries or go to, like, 30 issues, so they were nice runs, yeah.
That's still, like, an ongoing series, but I feel like they got away from themselves a bit, and there's not really a solution to this, in quotes, problem, is they would set something up, and then, like, their schedule would fall off, like, sort of like early Image.
I never saw those scheduling problems. My Image books always pretty much came out on time, or they would say that they're taking a 3-month break sometimes.
See, this is the thing. I think it's better to have a schedule than not to have a schedule, or do a skip month, or do whatever. Like, even I know some people still say, "Oh, the momentum is broken," but a schedule is still better than no schedule when you don't know a book is coming back. And you can't really solve that. Like, the guy's doing an indie book. Any solution you impose is still not going to get you all the parties to be happy with what's happening.
No, but I think Phil's right. They trained us to expect on the big titles that there are going to be breaks. Saga took them. I mean, The Walking Dead didn't really in the same way.
Nailbiter would take a break every, like, 12 issues kind of thing.
Well, they came up. We've heard Greg Rucka discuss it on Suntress's show and multiple other creators, now that I'm thinking about it, that there is this regular schedule of doing, like, X number of books, and then you take 2 months off, you have the trade, and then you start back up again. If that's the model they've created.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't exist more than 10 years ago.
Well, what's been interesting is, and as we talked about with its limitations and everything, I did look up the Diamond numbers, and Image is usually the top indie. In 2011, Spawn 200 was on the list as the second. And the first one was actually an IDW book. And that was the Godzilla book. And why that one was on there is, I don't know if you remember another great trend that this decade, and it was the variant covers. That was all the store covers. You guys remember that, right?
Yeah.
Because when I first looked, I'm like, Godzilla, King of the Monsters. And I was like, oh, that's right. They were the first one that decided to do all those store covers. And so they sold. That was the top-selling indie book of the year through Diamond, because every store could have their own store featured, which I thought was a clever gimmick. I mean, you know, variant covers being a mixed bag at best.
Did you look at the sales for graphic novels? Because some Image graphic novels sell crazy. Like, they sell almost as much as, like, the monthlies. And that makes me a lot.
I just went through the floppies. Like, 2012 had Walking Dead number 100.
Mm-hmm.
That was the top indie. And then the number two indie, to no one's surprise, another IDW book, My Little Pony number one.
Again,
about a million variant covers. 2013, it was two Images. Number one, and it was the number one seller overall, was Walking Dead 115.
What?
And that's pretty impressive to slay Marvel and DC, who normally have the top slots with their various. Like, in 2011, the New 52 obviously did well for DC.
Mm-hmm.
And then the number two book was another Image book, Jupiter's Legacy, number one. You guys remember that one, right?
That's surprising.
The superheroes being bad boys. And then 2014.
Wow, we haven't seen that before.
Was Walking Dead number 134, was the second overall. And then the second Image book was Outcast number one. Another Kirkman.
That's surprising.
Kirkman was hot.
Yes. And then 2015 was two surprises. The number two indie book was Orphan Black number one. IDW ended up picking up a lot of licenses.
Yeah, they did.
Sort of away from Dark Horse, which I used to think of as the one. And the number one book was Bravest Warriors Tales of Hollow John number one from Boom.
Weird.
Yeah.
And do you want to know why Do you know why that one was there? Not Adventure Time. It was the Loot Crate comic. Remember when Loot Crate?
Okay.
Is that fair? Loot Crate orders 250,000 copies or whatever, and then it makes the list?
It should not count, but.
It does. That was just
That's not indie enough. Sorry.
Mentioning those mentioning those couple of books makes me think of that. What you just touched upon, that IDW and Dynamite also really dug their heels in as like the licensed property companies
or
but you know, IDW, they've got the saving grace of having those artist editions that they've come across doing those nice old collections of things, not just the artist editions but other old strips and stuff too, which is nice. And then Boom, they really had their big whole kids line of books, the Kaboom stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Where they had all the Cartoon Network properties, Regular Show, Adventure Time, Clarence, World of Gumball, my favorite, Uncle Grandpa. But those are all gone now, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they also had originally the Disney license. They had the Muppets, the Incredibles, Uncle Scrooge, Disney. Sure. Yeah. All that's now at IDW, who also has the Marvel Kids line. So they have the Hasbro stuff, the Marvel, and that includes the My Little Pony. Yeah, the artist edition started with Rocketeer in 2010. The Portfolio edition, those are the ones where it's just a few pages. Those were 2012, and the Artifact edition, 2014. Artifact is when it's mostly incomplete issues. So that's what kept them on my list. But, Phil, I know you love TMNT.
Yeah.
They're AIDW.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Turtles.
So you gotta love them. And then, like I said, they kind of... Poor Dark Horse was the one I feel with the loss of the Star Wars, Conan, Hellboy is still there, but not booming like it was. And Buffy ended up going to Boom.
But Dark Horse, I think, makes a lot off their probably Japanese ones they bring over, though.
Yeah, they do a significant number. And they also do those other, like, art books and, like, Zelda, Final Fantasy, and all that stuff, too.
It wasn't just Hellboy. I mean, Hellboy died, right? I mean, that was... And then they went back and to tell old stories of, mm-hmm. you know, like prequel Hellboy-type stories. But even those are just down to being one-shots here and there now, or like two-issue-type real short limited series. But also the long-running BPRD series ended, mm-hmm. and the Abe Sapien series that was like 30-something issues also ended. So some really long-running series in the Mignola-verse all wrapped up, and now it really is scattershot what comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and now we have Black Hammer.
Yeah, that's really what's saving the company now, that's for sure.
And I don't recall that title.
And one other bit of the Conan that you mentioned, losing the Conan license, they did reach the peak of their handling of Conan, though, in those Tim Truman and Giorello, with the Giorello art, those King Conan. I think there was three of them, the Scarlet Citadel, Phoenix on the Sword, and the Hour of the Dragon, that were just incredible.
What about Queen of the Black Coast? That was pretty good.
It's all right.
Yeah. Well, I also enjoyed that those other companies, Dynamite did some artist editions, and Boom, and so now I feel like reproductions of original art are everywhere.
Yeah.
Yay!
Yeah, I think Image did a few, right? With Black Science or something?
You're leaving money on the table. People want that. You can't afford it. Original art itself has increased so much in price that, you know, for $100 to get 50 pages reproduced faithfully, is you're never going to barely get a page of art for $100 unless it's some unknown.
Even DC put out those unwrapped or something like that, unplugged type versions of, they're not oversized, but it's the original pencils of, you know, like Capullo and Jim Lee and all that sort of business, which is, that's always fun. And there were a couple of Archie art books that came out not too long ago. One that was maybe a Betty Veronica book, and one that was maybe 50 years of Archie covers or something like that. And the amount of original art that was scanned into those books versus just having you know, copies of you know, whatever their archives are is really cool. There's all kind. I felt like I was half of it's an artist edition.
Yeah, the graphics company is the one that did the DC books. They did also did the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen because they bought Wildstorm and a couple of the old Batman done in the full reproduced size.
That's why you see them. That's why you see them with the T-shirts in the previews.
They're the DC outlet, but yeah. Just to finish the list, 2016 saw more Loot Crate. It was Big Trouble in Little China number one from Boom, and Mighty Morphin Power Rangers from Boom. Some of those, I mean,
I got those in a crate. I remember that crate.
And then Loot Crate stopped doing that because 2017 we're back.
I own a Valiant Loot Crate issue.
Well, they stopped ordering the kind of numbers I think that we're putting on the list because 2017 number one and two for indie books was Walking Dead 164 and 162.
Well, Loot Crate went under, or at least the one I got, they went bankrupt.
Well, I was wondering, maybe the mystery box industry wasn't as stable as I thought.
No, it's not anymore. It's definitely isn't.
Well, you can still buy them at shows. Boxes of garbage you wouldn't pay for. But if I put it in a mystery box, you'll pay me $20 for stuff I couldn't
give away. I used to like it because I'd get this horror one, and it was made in Toronto. So for the amount I paid, I think it was under $30, and I got an awesome horror T-shirt and a magazine I bought every month anyway, Rue Morgue, which that more than covered, you know, the price right there. And then I got the extra stuff. So for me, that box was worth it. But a lot of them were just trash, though. A lot of those more geekier ones.
I didn't know that Rue Morgue was Canadian. I see that on the on the magazine stands.
Yeah, that's I love that magazine. I still get it all the time.
Nice. And then 2018 was, again, Image, Magic Order number one, and Walking Dead number one, the 15th anniversary issue. How many of those have people been trying to pass off?
Yeah.
It makes me sad that Walking Dead is on every, you know, like it's just Walking Dead over and over again. Like I wish some more other titles would pop up, you know, that might surprise us.
Well, he became a founder for a reason.
Yeah.
Magic Order. Is that the Mark Miller book?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a big seller of 2018.
That was a great book, but wow. That was another thing about the decade, right? Was just like the rise of the Mark Miller verse of books where he's just was knocking one idea after another out of the park, each with a different artist. I thought he's come out with a lot of different fun. I really like that Starlight one that he did with Parlov, and there's been a whole bunch. The Empress one, and the, and some of that is with the, I don't know, domination of Image putting out all those different properties rather than acting like they have like a core bunch of titles that they put out regularly, plus we have room for other stuff. Now it's just like all of the, like I was saying, it's just they put out all those different limited series and stuff. Marvel and DC pretty much gave up the indie type imprints that they had, and that's, you know, freed up Mark Miller to bring his stuff elsewhere, but he had been doing the stuff under that Marvel icon, remember? And then DC had always had the Vertigo with the quasi ownership, and then they tried to rejuvenate that, and then that has finally died out.
Yeah, and even now, I think it seems like they replaced the Vertigo with that horror line.
And I also feel like I've bought some of the books, but I think the Burger Books imprint has not. I just don't know if the market is quite there. I think there's so many different options. It's hard for one. Kind of the idea that like I'm going to get all my weird indie stuff from one isn't quite the same.
And you think part of the reason that Image shifted to more of that, I mean, is there just more pitches for these shorter ideas out there because people are trying to get that next Netflix deal like Mark Miller did?
I think that's part of it. I also think it's a huge grind, I think. Comics are a labor, despite what Kevin says, comics are a labor-intensive media.
I think there's a lot of long-running series, too. I think you're downplaying the series that are running long.
And I feel like for a person to put in those kind of crazy hours and be like, that's what I'm going to do, especially if you're an artist, that's all I'm going to do for the next 30 years. I mean, it's impressive. There are guys doing it. Ron Randall, Jim Ballant. Like, there are people that like, yeah, that's my jam. And I'm going to do Spawn to whatever extent. Todd McFarlane, I don't really track how much involvement he has, but there are people that do it. But I think the thought of like, why don't instead I tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end, kill myself for it, spend a decade or however long, and then move on to the next thing. I think that's more appeal. I don't blame anybody who's like, yeah, I'm going to spend 15 hours a day, 6 days a week on this thing for 10 years. That's a good amount of time.
Yeah, I'm not criticizing the industry for having those types of or that kind of shift as I'm seeing it. I just think that that's what I'm seeing. I think the Miller model is like the dream, right? I mean, he's just shooting out idea after idea, each to a different artist. Not only is it successful critically in the industry, comic book industry, but also you know, they all make good trades and all that sort of business, and they sold good as regular issues. But then, boom, Netflix buys the lot of everything, and he turned, you know, he passed a lot of that. I know from some of the friendships I have of the artists, he passed a lot of money on to his different artists and made a lot of artists, gave them a nice payday for as a result of that Netflix stuff. That's pretty cool.
Still not really my thing, though.
Very cool. Very cool to spread the wealth. And now's the time. Look, there's Netflix, there's Amazon, there's Disney Plus, there's Hulu. There's all these outlets to pitch to, plus all the regular cable and TV. I mean, if you got an idea, I would have never predicted Wynonna Earp would have been a big TV show. I didn't realize it had a big following.
It has a big
from following. Its 90s. It had a must have had enough to land a TV deal.
I have every issue.
Sell those issues, Bill. Sell.
All right, Andrew, finish your list. I took you off track again.
No, it's good. The last was 2019, which, like 2011, sees Spawn 300 as the number 2 book on the list. And Spawn 301 was number 11. And then the last, Walking Dead 193, was 42 on the list.
Wow.
So I think it's funny it starts and ends with Spawn being like big sellers, because that's Image and that's a big deal. But yeah, I thought that was, I've forgotten till I looked at the list about the store specific variant covers and the loot crate thing that this decade brought to us.
What I like for other outlets is the rise of the Kickstarter model for self-publishing. We've had a lot of creators do their thing and get their book out and kind of have it be like a regular event or a couple of times a year. Or there's been the Dan Parent and Fernando Ruiz, Die Kitty Die, The Skies of Fire, Joe Picar's Red Velvet, the Ditko Snyder books. I mean, you know, they, and to a lesser extent, the Comixology too is another outlet for people to get their indie books out there, which is fun. It gives you a more direct route to some real indie talents.
Yeah, Kickstarter kicked off in April of 2009. I first went there, I think, in 2010 with Reading with Pictures or Athena Voltaire.
Oh, you don't want to know mine. The worst story and the best story, it was like literally at the same time.
And I'm closing in on almost 200 successful Kickstarters I've backed. Wow. Yeah.
You know, the real indie guys, though, we're counting backers. The amount of stores that sell indie books and then calling those stores to get them to stock their book, or they were doing mail order. That's where it was at. Copra!
Besides those, although those successful pledges just mean successful on Kickstarter, it doesn't mean I ever got the book. And close to 100 unsuccessful. So it had its mix. And there's other Kickstarters, just the big one. But I think it came, and I think it's been eclipsed by Patreon, which came out 4 years later. I haven't dipped in, but I know, Steve, you have done some Patreon.
Yep. Still do.
I'm sure someday I'll break that. I'm just nervous. It's a, those recurring charges are the ones I always end up forgetting about. And then
yeah, but realizing... Andrew, I back like 4 or 5 creators, and my thing is like, I don't know, like $6 a month or something. I'm all, yeah, I don't, sorry guys, I'm not chipping in a lot. I don't have a lot to chip in. I just want to see your pinups.
And then Kevin and I've sworn off it. I don't know if you're still doing it, but I also dipped in 2010, saw the start of the Humble Bundle, which I bought a bunch on and then have quit because it just sits on a digital file somewhere with, like, I've got a couple hundred books from the Dynamite and the Boom and all these other ones where I'm like...
You know what else I heard you say? You're like, I don't feel like donating to charity if I'm not reading these books.
Sure. That's exactly what I said. I just feel like I have enough problems with paper that I need to read. When it's digital, I don't even remember it exists half the time. So it's a bad habit. And I was just buying this stuff, not because I wanted it, but it was like $20 and you'd get like 300 comics or something. And I'm like, no, that's the wrong way. But we still have web comics too, guys.
Although I feel you mean like... XKCD?
Yeah.
Those are big.
Yeah. I got, for Christmas this year, I got the printed book. The guy wrote a couple, turned them into books. So it's gone full circle. The digital turns into paper.
Well, you got to sell that merchandise.
So I guess I'm winning after all. And then on a sad personal note, the trend I did not like is the moving from forums onto general social media.
Yeah.
I mean, I like social media, but I really miss... I feel like the forums had a way of you could just have an ongoing conversation, and if you had to be busy, you could leave it for a day or a week and then just pick that conversation right back up and see who contributed. And
yeah, we had our home boards and we hung out there, and come on, the three of us owned those boards.
I miss comic news. Like when you couldn't make money, the comic news was better.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to be but I did want to pour one out for the lost forums. I feel like it's a different animal, but I really enjoyed interacting with people that way. And then, as Kevin notes from his list, there was a ton of adaptations. Things, and we've touched on this before, you know, Netflix and TV and all these tons of things.
Yeah, and it's weird that, like, Netflix got involved in... like, not just, like, regular, like, live-action TV, but, like, animated stuff. So, that's certain. And we've seen a lot of that, too, with Crunchyroll and everything. Like, it's a lot easier to get animated stuff and anime and all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, should we steal from Marvel and have our manga minute that Kevin can run?
Well, I give big props for bringing back like the only manga I ever, or anime, I should say, that I ever really had a soft spot in my heart for, because I used to watch it episodically as a kid. No, the Star Blazers when I was a kid. And they redid that in the 2014, I think, with the Star Blazers 2199 and 2220 or whatever they are. The great, great series updating with the newer animation techniques and stuff. Man. Just looks so sharp and so great. Good old Star Blazers, the Yamato.
Yeah, and as Kevin also notes, we had the cons got even bigger.
Yeah, cons. Indie cons. Not just mainstream cons, but like indie cons. And then one saw what the other one was doing, and then those like replicated themselves as well.
Yeah, I feel like now I can go... And what I also love is every year there's always all those con bubble arguments like, oh, they've gone too far. And then every year there's more of them and they're more popular and everything. So, I mean, I'm sure at some point it'll cut back. And there are cons that fail, but I feel like it's not like it's the bubble has burst or anything, people. There's plenty of shows. As Kevin says, little shows or big shows or everything.
You remember the other bubble bursting at the end of the 2000s with manga?
I do not. You're our Eastern correspondent, Kevin.
Well,
give it to
us. Yeah, that's kind of weird. Yeah, but there was that, like, that was massive, like massive readership, massive bookstore, like presence that just grew and grew and grew. And then by, I don't know, at some point in the later 2000s there, but yeah, there was kind of a manga glut and everything went downhill, and then slowly it built itself back up. And then you had, like, Attack on Titan and all those crazy things that came out.
Well, the key was winning Phil over. Because he'll just buy everything all at once.
That's right. So. You're welcome, Kevin.
How many volumes? 200? Sold.
Exactly. One Piece? I want all those volumes. One Piece is huge. You can't understate how massive One Piece is.
I did control myself on that one because there's way too many.
I love that about you, Phil. If you like something, you're like, I'll buy all of it. It's very, very cool to just be boss and take it all over.
Well, I'll do that before I read it, but that's the collector mentality of me, like, because I have to have it all, right, at once. I can't just buy one volume of something sometimes. I need to get it all at once.
And I think some of the shows and manga releases sort of synced up more closely, so like you would buy the book and watch the show and vice versa, and then the time it was being released in Japan and the time it's being released here, it's like way closer now.
And Kevin, you're also our art comics expert. Do you want to talk about, I feel that's really blown up with some big names who now even sometimes deign to do superhero work.
See, that's a weird thing. Like, there's definitely some art comics guys that I'm like not into, and they had some publishers that blew up or went under that I wasn't really there for. And then there's other guys like Michael DeForge and everything, and Adventure Time he was involved with too. I think it was a designer or something, where he started putting out some comics that I think he became pretty big. Or then like the Hark of Vagrant and stuff like that. Like there was a lot of stuff. I usually saw like a lot of the stuff at TCAF, and then Koyama Press, Study Group, Short Box, Youth and Decline. A lot of cool stuff.
I think Lisa Hannawal worked on the Netflix show BoJack Horseman. I think that was her. Like, she had a very prominent role. Another kind of indie art comics person. So it's interesting to see them have these other things blow up for them and get big. Well, they still have their adherence in the art comics fandom. Yeah.
I know some of the art comics, it just sometimes it gets too far into the, hey, there's a scribble on this page type of thing. And I'm like, I'm not there for that.
What about the stuff that breaks into that more psychedelic realm? Like, it's been a good decade for folks like Johnny Ryan's Prison Pit.
Yeah, that kind of stuff too, yeah.
And Andrew McLean with, like, Headlopper and Apocalyptic Girl, and even now, who's the guy with the Space Riders? Alexis Zerit stuff.
Yeah, he's really good.
And the Tomahawk, you know, all that stuff is, that stuff's pretty cool.
I find some of that stuff gets a little more polished than Your basement stapled comics?
Oh, yeah. But that's some of the, that lends itself to the psychedelicness of it.
Yeah,
and some of
yeah.
the, you know, it's underground, but it's above ground, you know? I even felt that way to a lesser extent. I mean, it's even more polished, like of Trad Moore's stuff with the Luther Strode trilogy that we enjoy that stuff.
Yeah, that Silver Surfer Black, I got the
that's
oversized.
Unreal. They did a big sized edition, like a treasury edition of that stuff.
Yeah.
I just read it. I want to just go in and have someone white out like a third of the word balloons.
That's mean. Yeah. Just skip over them like I did, dude.
Oh, you guys are mean.
Why put what? Like, you don't need nearly
There's
this
not
many
a lot.
Words,
you're
dude.
Saying he's. You're acting like he's Chris Claremont over those issues, and he isn't.
I'm just saying that's a pretty book, and it doesn't need a lot of. Where no one needs the twists and turns, but yeah, I thought it was fun in our personal development. Like I said, Phil got into Valiant, got out. Phil, you got into manga this year.
Got out.
This decade.
Got out.
And you're still the Action Lab saw their mature line.
Oh, got out of that too. Of
you know, but it's you a Vamp Blade a lot of the, and all that.
Yeah,
anymore?
No, I still get Vamp Blade.
Okay.
Yeah. So you still got that, and you got in and out of Zenoscope.
Yeah, that I did get out of. Yeah, I can't even. There's nothing I can enjoy by them anymore.
But you know, we'll always have Ginger Dead Man, Phil.
Yep, and hopefully we'll get a third mini.
And I'm excited. I'm glad that Action Lab, because they seem like one that I was always worried they would not like have some horrible setback and disappear.
Yeah. Yeah, but I find they've really slowed down, though. That's why I don't get really a lot from them right now. Like, I wish they would start putting out more books again.
They're like Valiant. They only put out... I don't know how many they put out, but I know Valiant slowed their pace a little bit, too.
Well, I think it's... I mean, I feel like with those little companies, you know, one bad... You get screwed over by a vendor or something, it could put the company at risk. Because I remember a company we don't talk about much anymore. We used to, Moonstone out of Chicago.
Yeah.
They were kind of like Dynamite Light.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all those like pulp characters. And I haven't seen them in the stores and forever. I mean, look, companies go, companies come. Vault and Aftershock and
Scout.
We got new people. TKO presents new companies on the scene. But I feel like it's sad when the old ones go away too.
I mean, there's usually reasons.
But I feel like I've been talking about Steve. We need to get you back in here.
All right. How about let's see. Oh, I really like the Jeff Darrow Shaolin Cowboy miniseries that popped up this last decade.
Mm-hmm.
And Marjorie Liu's and Sana Takeda's Monstrous,
yes.
I think, has been a real highlight the last few years. Rick Remender's Black Science wrapped up.
All the Rick Remender stuff. This Dead the Class,
where'd he go?
Low.
Where's he at?
He's pumping out Lazarus.
Rucka's Lazarus, I thought, hit a real high point and then totally fizzled, like, for a lack of attention, and now it's trying to do its own version of its namesake and rise itself from the dead with a few more limited series here.
It's so weird because it's in that like 80 page RPG quarterly, like no other book is doing like that type of schedule.
And you know who else has a nice solid way of doing these little limited series, but it's all the creator and it's really I always wait for the collection, and it's such good stuff, and I can't believe he's still doing it, and we're fortunate enough to still be able to go to our stands and pick it up, is Walt Simonson's Ragnarok. I mean, Walt's still putting out incredible pages, maybe some of his best pages ever, and telling Thor stories. It's so cool.
You know, we mentioned a lot of companies, but what about the merger of companies? Like Top Shelf was its own thing.
Yeah.
Lion Forge was its own thing. A lot of these places. And then they sort of just...
Wildstorm?
That goes back.
Oh, what about Bandette, Kevin?
Oh, that was kind of the sad, like, rise of digital and then Monkey Brain. And it's like, oh, yeah, readers are going to... Digital's going to keep rising and gaining readers forever, and then I guess you've kind of reached a saturation point.
Yeah, I wish Monkey Brain made it.
Yeah, but Bandette's still kicking around, so.
Well, I like that model, and also one of my favorite colorists and art illustrators out there, Richard Sala, the way he does stuff, is put out a webcomic and just put the pages up so you kind of can still get a taste of what he's doing and get to see new pieces by him. Richard Sala.
I don't recognize that name.
And then, you know, with the Violencia and all that good stuff. And then what was the other one? The something grotesquely and There's been a few of them. Then he puts them out in published form after that.
And nice full color original artwork you can buy off him. Thanks, Steve, again for cluing me into that.
Yeah, you got. Do have I seen the pages that you have? You got to show me them sometime.
Yeah, yeah, I'm very, very pleased, especially in comparison with what I feel the explosion of the original art market. I feel like his prices are very competitively still like a complete steal when you look at some of these other things. I think that's, it's some, I don't know, the guy's crazy talented, I think, and I really like his books. I'm glad in some ways, but sad for him that they haven't exploded in the way they should have.
Shout out to Previews for always changing your catalogs. You made the order form tiny, so I didn't have any space to read. Then you don't have the order due date on the form, or you made the page all glossy, so I couldn't write on it. Ah, oh, Previews.
I don't know what that is, Kevin.
then you put. Granted, they broke away from their model of only having a few companies in the front. But then it's like images first, and I'm like, why isn't this in alphabetical order? We'll put the novels in with the comics. Like, I never know what's really going on there.
How about those great Tom Scholey books, the Transformers, G.I. Joe, and then the GoBots? Those were awesome.
This is the thing where I'm like, if I was rating like best books of the year, I'm like, do I include these? But if I was gonna say like most enjoyable or had the most fun discussing over the years, like some of those books are just really fun to talk about.
Terry Moore's Rachel Rising, that was a great book. There's been a lot. It's been a good decade. I'm personal favorite, and it's the last one I'll shoot out, and I guess it's appropriate for this time of year, is I really enjoyed Grant Morrison and Dan Mora's Klaus books. Another one that, I mean, it came out with a couple of limited series, one limited series 1 year, another the next year. They have both nice hardcover collections. But then every year after, they've been coming out with like a nice extra length one shot type story. And this year was no exception. And great little winter tale.
Man, there's been a ton of, I'm glad you brought up Tom, because I feel like I bring him up every other one. But I feel we've had some fun. It shows that some of these licensed books aren't just going to be the same old stuff, which I think is fun. Like, I'm glad the company holders were like, let's let someone do crazy, because we also had those two Dick Tracy reboots, Steve, you may remember from not that long ago.
Yeah.
That
what about Clue?
Clue? I didn't read that one.
Candlestick.
I don't have a clue. I think that this new shift of people, Kirkman, I guess his little manifesto worked, right? The Kirkman thing of doing time at the big two and then having an indie life.
Let's see how many people followed his manifesto and get the next Walking Dead. That's how we'll judge him. Because well, I think that was the thing, TV right? Just start your indie book, get big at the big two, then your indie book will just take off and you'll be the next cultural sensation.
Hey, as Steve pointed out, Miller, it worked. He seemed to have jumped on that bandwagon.
And at least Kirkman stepped out of the way and took his Walking Dead book with him. So it's like, all right, he even left a vacuum for you to fill.
Well, I think Saga is the book, I think, that jumped in. Saga. I don't know how we say it. How do you say it?
I don't know. Tonight I'm on the loose. That's
Sega? Sega?
Sega, there we go. Sega Genesis? Sonic the Hedgehog? Whatever book they got coming out of there.
I have some of my awards here. I know you love awards in a list.
Oh,
judging from the Thunderbolt segment.
Do it.
So I'm not going to go through every one of these, but I'll give you a few categories for some of my years. Like 2010, favorite writer, Ed Brubaker. Like, obviously, from all, like, with him and Sean Phillips, like, crazy successful team from Criminal, Fatale, The Fade Out, Killer Be Killed.
I mean, think of what that book did for Archie. It made them take their risks and do their whole afterlife with Archie thing, and then all of the other contemporary Archie and the different art Archie and everything that led up to their Riverdale success.
Then for 2011, I have Michael DeForge, who we talked about. I always try to make Steve laugh with those books, usually.
Well, you make me cry, Kevin. So.
With his counterfeit Spider-Man book, where it's Aunt May and Doc Ock. Classic. Classic.
They belong together.
2012, Matt Kent. How can I not mention Matt Kent?
Boy, you've gone off of him based on our 2019 show. Well, I wasn't going to mention him.
The famous mind management issue that was silent, but not really silent.
I finally spent a little time talking to Matt Kent in Baltimore this year, and that's cool. He's a cool guy. He's a good guy to talk to.
2013, I guess I was all hyped up on the Prophet and everything, Brandon Graham.
I feel like he's kind of
a good one.
Had a rocket to the ship, and then I don't know what he's doing now. Once the island, he had that anthology.
I don't really want to talk about it.
When Paul Pope is putting out more work than you, you need to check your schedule and figure out what are you doing with your time.
Just don't look him up for comic based news. Just don't look that up. 2015, Jonathan Hickman,
because of his
Image work and his Marvel work. And then, of course, I stopped, you know, because you can't have ratings going through a whole, you know, that's just not the way.
Then this show started.
I think you've unlocked it. I did skip 2014, though, but that's because there was no 11 o'clock Oscars that year.
I went back and looked at all of the show notes to all of the episodes of Indie Noise that we've done, and every book that I mentioned tonight was a book that we talked about on the show or another.
You never brought up Casanova on the show?
I did, and I had this on my list, but I skipped mentioning it.
Then Atomic Robo, who moved out of Red 5 and became a big thing on their own.
Rocketo.
Yeah, that was good too, but that was a previous decade.
Yeah.
That's another thing. I'm like, I would so love for like that series to come back. That series is never coming back, is it?
No.
There was like supposed to be like six or something. We got two. So disappointing. And of course, my book of the year for many years, it seems like here, our favorite ongoing was 20th Century Boys, 21st Century Boys. It's incredible.
That's got to be one of those Valiant titles, right, Steve?
Manga.
No, I know. I've read. That's still going on? I thought.
No, it finished up.
Okay, because I'm like, I thought I read that years ago, and then I'm like, wait, it's still happening? No, I like that one. I like that one. I like.
Yeah, it's very popular. That one, yeah.
Or the weird. Young teenage angst manga, Flowers of Evil.
We talked about that quite a bit. Seems a little pervy.
It's better than mine, Don't Touch My Teenage Daughter, that I got by accident.
You almost made me want to read that, Phil.
Well, it sounds awesome premise. You know, a daughter superhero and a mother superhero. You know, the daughter's learning how to be a superhero. But yeah, it went dark.
Maybe my favorite indie issue, if I was going to... This would definitely be in the top 10, pretty close. Frontier Number 7 from Youth in Decline by Jillian Tamaki is about the story of the MP3 and how it goes around and the sound gets around the internet and people listen to it. Just a crazy story.
You also talked a lot about Pope hats all the time.
Oh, of course, the Pope hats. Pope hats is great. Some legal and slice of life. Perfect combination. You know what else was pretty close to a perfect combination? Those Parker graphic novels from Darren Cook.
Yeah, those were good. I just ordered the whatever super duper version of it, because I had only read them digitally, which was fine because it was almost made for a landscape held iPad with its page design, but they just made some kind of champagne edition or something.
Martini?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Lovecraft Cult Bard GNs as well.
Those are nice. The ones I got, I enjoyed. I should probably find what ones I'm missing. They're always so well done.
Speaking of Lovecraft, this was the decade that Alan Moore left comics for real.
Did he? Did he really?
Yeah.
I found he was doing something else coming up.
Is he done with League?
I think the last one just wrapped up.
Okay. And then he was just doing that movie magazine thing and
Cinema Purgatory, something like that.
Oh, yeah, that one. Yeah,
remember you had the Dolce Gemologic one?
I liked Providence a lot. I'm not a huge Jason Burroughs guy.
That was great. I loved the covers. I loved the
I thought that it worked. Like, the two of them found a way. Like, I'd never been a Jason Burroughs guy, but their partnership seemed to bring out a lot in both of them.
I like Jason Burroughs. I think that was the perfect type of comic to enjoy his art. Like, he's good at that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Because we didn't really talk Avatar, but I think Phil's probably the
other. I got Avatar, a lot of Avatar.
Crossed and all that stuff.
Yeah, I feel ashamed for Ring Cross. It was a nasty comic.
You know what we might feel ashamed for? Is all this indie talk and no Fantagraphics.
No, I mentioned Richard Sala. He puts out all his stuff from Fantagraphics, and you pretended not to know who he was, and it threw me off, but...
I'll throw out another one that's not your typical, I think, Fantagraphics, or what I think of Fantagraphics, like some of their European stuff, like the Jacques Tardy stuff, like the like a sniper lining up his shot.
I have that story. One. And then there is the... we also didn't talk about Titan Publishing. They did those excellent Charlie's Wars reprints, the Pat Mills, Cole Coy, World War One comic. It came out in these big hardcovers. Like, they're thin, but they're really nice. I think there was 10 of them or something. All nice, sitting on my shelf, looking pretty.
If IDW is taking over all the licenses... What do I gotta give for them to start up the Mega Man comic anyways? Like Archie was doing the whole, all the video game
Sonic
stuff there?
And all that, yeah. I did some of the Archie horror that Steve mentioned, but that I'm out of Archie now. I just played around with it for a little bit. And I know they still come out because Vampironica and all that's still happening.
It's not the same writer there, so I'm not there. Like, I was there for the Smallwoods, and once you got, like, someone else on it, I'm like, I can't do it.
The regular Archie stuff, especially the seasonal one-shots that come out, the stuff that's by Dan Parent and Jeff Schultz and Fernando Ruiz, the stuff that's in the classic, you know, DiCarlo Goldberg style, that stuff is still good. Nice and colorful and Archie-ish. But, yeah, I mean, now there's all these other choices and stuff, and if those are considered the front of the line, and if that's what the company is to be judged on, then they've definitely floundered a little bit.
You know what I had to check to see if it could squeak in was Aphrodisiac.
Because
I'm like, did that come out this decade? Because I've picked up a decent amount of Jim Rugg stuff.
Stoko's Godzilla came out in his Aliens book. You know, those are good.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you briefly mentioned it before, Andrew, but just for pure art and color and oftentimes, surprisingly enough, story, Fun Comics is Jim Balent's Tarot, The Witch of the Black Rose. It's a fun book, especially now that it's been around for, what, like 200 issues now or something ridiculous, or 100 issues.
Yeah.
They have a established... world, and the characters are really well developed, and some of the stories he tells, especially, you know, it's very Hellboyish, and they go back into little legends and mythologies that are folklorish and do a comics book version of them. But the colors and stuff are, it's a really well produced book, and holding the line at only $2.95. What? After all these years.
That is pretty crazy. I just remember getting introduced to that title basically through like an infamous, I think it was Comics Alliance article. Like I probably knew about it somehow in some way. Like you sort of pick up things from all over.
I mean, the boobies are too big, but the page composition and a lot of it is really done very esoterically and psychedelically, and this great big full page spreads that are full compositions that have all kinds of images running through it, and pixies in the corners doing stuff. It's very detailed, fun labor of love type book, right up there with Larson's Savage Dragon as a book that is just such a, seems like such a reflection of the creator that it makes you smile when you read it and think of the creator like, ah, man, Larson, hilarious dude.
So is Six Gun the longest running Oni, or was the longest running Oni Press series?
Has to have been.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Because Rick and Morty, right, might...
Oh, yeah, Rick and Morty might have beat it.
Yeah.
That's true.
Also, Scott Pilgrim ended from them, and that launched Brian Lee O'Malley into his, I guess, maybe more unconventional way at the time for an indie creator to, like, get big, but not now.
Not like this. Not like this.
Not like this.
Hey, I'll take that movie money any day of the week.
It's
but
true.
As we meant, as... Oh, I was just going to say, as we mentioned, some of the creators that kept going, Terry Moore, Steve, you mentioned, Steve Ditko obviously was going, and that's still going, even though he's dead, and Cerebus came back. I mean, I haven't read any of that stuff since he's returned, but it was just funny to see everyone returning to kind of Ron Randall, I think, fired back up his Trekker stuff this decade.
I haven't read any of them, but the one-shot Cerebuses that have been solicited over the last year in the previews look really funny. I mean, they're total Marvel knockoffs or, you know, comics that we know and love and remember, and he's doing a twist on them. And that was always a fun aspect of the old Cerebus books back in the day, picking them up off the stands and seeing, you know, almost like the Tick did in its first bunch of issues with Ben Edlund, where it was riffing on comic book tropes. And they've been now thinking of them doing it in color and everything. They look cool. I haven't read any of them, though.
Do you remember when Dave Jordan got in my brain with Sadman? He thought he was writing Sandman, and then he put Sadman, and it birthed that whole comic. That was great.
Yeah, and our friends at Kingbone Press had some great books over the years. Although they need to step up their output a little bit.
That's for sure. You don't want a publisher fade. Pod fade and then publisher fade.
But I think any wrap-up thoughts, gentlemen? I think it was pretty fun looking back, but I'm excited for the next 10 years.
Well, I want to go read some comics.
Phil, anything you want to say?
Nope. I don't remember last week, so a decade's very hard for me.
Well, the horror goes on. Kevin?
In 2020... read even more indie comics.
Oh, all right. Well, hopefully we don't have to wait 10 years to get the four of us back together again. But thank you for listening, and keep making mine independently comic book noise.
Remember Later. Blood Squirt? 10 news!